Okay. The second announcement is actually I want to announce like a special seminar. So not this Friday, the following Friday, our very distinguished colleague, Jonathan Sammet, actually told me that he's going to give a seminar. You know, sometime on Friday afternoon, there is a special seminar prior happy hour that they are given like on the big. So the topic of the seminar will be, is biostatistics necessary? he said, emailed me last night and asked me, do you think people will be interested? I said, I will, and I'm coming with tomatoes. So I'm supposed to introduce him with respect to this lecture, which makes me pretty nervous. So we'll see how much in trouble he's going to get. So it's not this Friday, the following Friday, I'm sure it will be announced, but it will be interesting to see, at least you know, if all of this is worth it or not, based on his opinion. Okay, so now I know that you have been reviewing a lot of material today. So I just have one question, which I want to have a little bit of feedback from you. There are two options. Option one, I can spend another 20 minutes to rediscuss robust estimation and the data analysis of the Sitka trees. And I know that you have reviewed that in lab. Or I can just go directly to the new topic, which is the parametric model for the covariance matrices and the variogram. So I just would like, for the people that think I could go ahead with a new topic, if you can please raise your hand. Okay, well, let me try in a different way then. Let me try the conservative. Can you please raise your hand so I can see you for people that think I should go this one more time? Okay, that was clear enough. Okay, so I'm going to do robust estimation. I'm going to go quickly because we need to kind of move. But I can see that it's not the most simple thing to do. So we talk about robust estimation and the generalized least square estimation when we are not willing or we don't want to specify a parametric model for the covariance matrix. In any other circumstances in this course, we will also always specify a parametric model for the covariance matrix. But in some circumstances, especially when you have the individuals are measured at the same time point, we can basically leave the covariance matrix unstructured. And so by doing robust estimation, basically, we do this following thing. The number one, we estimate the beta, the point estimates for beta, by doing weighted least square, by picking a covariance matrix, a W, which we call the working covariance matrix. And often, really, the only thing we do, we just pick W equal to the identity matrix, because we know that whatever is the choice of W, the point estimate of beta is always going to be unbiased. But now, the point, what we've seen and discussed quite extensively is that if we misspecify W, the standard error of beta can be wrong. And in fact, the classical example is that if we have a correlated data and we use ordinal least square, we know that the variance of beta in many circumstances is actually going to be incorrect. So what we do, we robustify the variance of beta by doing this with this calculation. And actually, when I was on Monday, I actually never show you this equation, and that's probably why some of you were a little confused. So basically, what this is doing is calculating the variance of this guy plus this V hat. You see this V hat? A V hat is our, I would say, non-parametric estimate of that of V, which basically we do by feeding a saturated model for the mean and taking all the sum of square and all the, you know, the cross progress of the difference. So V at So what we did, and then we're going to do again, we do remember that we finished the class on Monday, and I show you exactly how you calculate VF for the Sitka trees. What we did, we specified different models for the dying point treatment, and we take all the square differences, and that's how we calculate VF. After we calculate VF, independent of how you pick W, by applying these two formulas, you always are going to get a consistent estimate of beta, and the standard error, that might not be optimal, but they will be robust. So you're always basically playing in a safe territory. Okay? And so you can have a W is equal to identity, or W is something that depends on the time difference, and in any circumstances, you're always going to have that your beta, which is a weighted least square estimate, will have a multivariate normal distribution with mean beta, means there will be unbiased, but with a statistical variance, RW, and basically RW account for this VF. Okay? Yes, because remember, the only situation where this is going to be optimal is when we pick W equal to V inverse. So the only situation where this is optimal when this guy is the maximal likelihood estimate. Okay? And when we did that at the beginning, we said, let's assume that V is known. Okay, and so you're gonna specify your likelihood function, and then you're gonna have your beta hat, which is x prime v inverse x prime v inverse y, and that's by definition is the maximum likelihood estimate, so has the minimum variance. Okay, so theoretically this is the best estimate that you can get. That basically is this guy with the W equals to v inverse. The problem is that we don't know V, okay? So because we don't know V, there are two things we can do. One is to specify a likelihood function with beta and V both unknown, and we can do maximum likelihood estimation of both of them. And so you can get basically these estimates, and that's what we saw on Monday. So on Monday, what we did a maximum likelihood estimation for both V and beta. And that will be the maximum likelihood estimate, so that will be the estimates with the minimum variance. But what happened is, in order to get that sorted out, you have to solve a maximization problem. You have to maximize the likelihood function with respect to the entire covariance matrix V. And sometimes that computation, the maximization problem is too computationally expensive, we can't do it. And so that is an approach which is suboptimal, because what we do, we estimate V, still maintaining V unstructured, but without doing maximal likelihood estimation. We estimate V by specifying the saturated model and applying this formula here. Remember this formula here, where basically so this is the saturated model, where basically you calculate the mean of all the observation for each combination time and the treatment, and you calculate all the square differences. So by doing robust estimation of V, you calculate V in this way, and then you get the beta and RW. Beta is simply our weighted least square, but we basically fix the standard error of W by taking this V hat. So this V hat here, it's not a maximal likelihood estimate. Therefore, it will not let in WLS with a minimum variance. Okay. You guys, please stop me and I ask, because I know this is confusing. I'm not claiming that. Okay. So, why don't we let me try to say it in a slightly different way? Okay, just one more time. There are really three ways. I mean, yes, let's see if that will... I'm just using these transparencies to write, okay? So it seems to me that there are really three ways. So let's assume that we have beta and V are both unknown, okay? Which is really our case. We don't know the vector of the regression coefficient, and we don't know the correlation structure, okay? So, and let's assume for now the data are balanced and equally spaced, okay? Because the next topic, we're going to get rid of the second of this assumption. So we can proceed in three ways, at least as far as I now remember, okay? So one, we specify a parametric model for V. Okay? So, for example, uniform. Then we have the likelihood function of beta and rho. And basically what we do, we maximize the likelihood function and we find beta hat, rho hat, and therefore we find the covariance matrix, which is a function of rho, right? So we have a likelihood function that will depend on beta. It will only depend on rho because our full covariance matrix, well, also depends on the day, sigma squared. But let me simplify for a moment. And so what we do, we maximize the likelihood function. We get beta hat and rho hat, and therefore you get the covariance matrix because basically this will have 1 and rho outside, okay? Then this guy here will be defined as x prime v inverse rho hat x prime v inverse rho hat y. Okay? So this guy here will be an MLE with the W equal to the v inverse, which is this guy here, right? And this will be a maximal likelihood estimate, will be the WLS, the weight of least square with minimum there. But we have made an assumption. We assume that V is uniform. So this guy will be an estimate of beta with minimum variance as much as our assumption that the correlation structure is uniform is a reasonable assumption. Similar thing, we could assume V is exponential. So if you have your autocorrelation function of the variogram, it clearly looks exponential. You've specified V to be an exponential correlation structure. You maximize the likelihood function for beta and for rho, and you get your maximal likelihood estimate, and you are done. Okay? But all of these force you to make an assumption about V. Okay? So is everyone clear about this? Then you have option number two, which is, I don't want to specify anything about V. I want to leave a V unstructured. So that means I need not only to estimate one parameter, but I need to estimate n times n plus 1 divided by 2 parameters. So if a V is unstructured, let's say n is equal to 5, you have a 5 measurement. Because the V is symmetric, we will need to estimate 5 times 6 divided by 2. So we will need to estimate 15 parameters. We can still do it. We can still specify the likelihood function for beta and for the entire V. And we need to maximize the likelihood function with respect to both. This is the same procedure, but now we need to maximize not respect to one parameter rho, but we need to maximize the respect to the entire covariance matrix. So 15, it really depends how much data we have, but you see it's already a lot with only 5 measurements. If you have 10, you're going to have 10 times 11 divided by 2. It's 11 times 5, 55. I mean, you know, your computer is going to break. Or even worse, you don't have enough data really to do it, enough patience, right? So then you're stuck. So what do you do? Then that's what is... So the second is a V unstructured but using MLE, which means basically to maximize the latent function as a function of beta and V. And the third is a V unstructured, but that is robust estimation. Okay? And how we do that? Forget the Laplace function. There is no Laplace function here involved. We do two things. One, we estimate V hat by number one, specifying a saturated model for the mean. And then basically using this formula here. Okay? And two, calculating beta doing Waverly square with W, I don't care which W you pick. And then calculating the standard error of beta by using this formula here. Okay, so the robust estimation is these two. One is this one, which you don't need to maximize the likelihood function, you just need basically to do half your computer to calculate sum of squares. And then you can estimate the beta and it's a standard error by applying this formula. And this will be a valid inference independently of how you pick W. And the reason is because for beta, independent of you pick W, beta is always going to be unbiased. And then we showed that last week. And for the standard error, independently of you're going to pick W, you will always properly weight for the F. Okay, so you will always correctly account for the correlation in the most flexible way as possible. Okay? So these are really the three approach as are in my mind. So is there any question about 1, 2, and 3? Did 1, 2, and 3 help? Yes, please. I know you look confused, so please. Yes. Right. Exactly right. Although you can use robust estimation only when the sequences are short. And you can specify a saturated model for the mean. It means that you have a treatment time interaction. If you have a continuous covariate, you can specify a parametric saturated model for the mean, and so you're kind of constrained. But you're right. I mean, that's why maybe we should do the Sitka example, because also I finished with exactly the discussion without the pros and cons. And, I mean, one of the things that is probably slightly confusing is that as most of the data analysis, there is not, you know, one unique way of doing things. I mean, you might have the couple, actually in some situation, you might actually want to do both and compare the results and see, you know, which one is more reasonable. But when, for example, but when you have a very long sequences with irregularly spaced observation, you cannot do anything. You cannot do robust estimation. No, you cannot do anything. You cannot do robust estimation. You can do other things, hopefully. So for the Sitka data set, so this was the data set, right, that you have. We have 2 years of data. So that was 5 measurements in 1988 and 8 measurements in 1989. And so basically what we would like to test, so these are the trees that were put in the treatment chamber, so we're under the ozone. And here are the trees that were under the control chamber, so without ozone. And basically what we'd like to do, we'd like to compare these curves with this curve, and this curve with this curve, to test the hypothesis of whether the treatment affects growth. And what we are going to do, we're going to do that separately for each of the 2 years. Okay, so we did analysis first for 1988 and first for 1989. Now what happened is that actually the chamber doesn't really matter. So at some point with analysis, we're just going to put these data and these data all together, these data and these data all together. So we just have two chambers there, right? So you see, one thing that's happening about these data is that you have that the sequence is short. You have only five time points. It's balanced. All the three are equally spaced and are measured always the same time, right? You have a lot of measurements at each time point. So this is the perfect situation for doing robust estimation. And so what we do is you can estimate Vs. Actually, I have another slide. Let's see. So I left today the lecture, I think, on Monday, saying that you can estimate Vx by, so you see, by specifying a saturated model for the mean. So what I mean by specifying a saturated model for the mean, I am allowing a different mean for each time point and the treatment interaction. So basically, how I obtain this curve, I take the average of this guy, I take the average of this guy, the average of this guy, and I connected all the points, okay? The only reason why I specify the saturated model for the mean, it's not to test the hypothesis, is there a treatment effect on size, it's only to estimate the covariance matrix, okay? So, because in this way, I'm just basically letting the data speak for themselves. It's the most flexible model you can specify. And you see, you estimate your V hat by doing what? So V0, remember, is a covariance matrix. So on the main diagonal, we'll have the covariances. Sorry, in the main diagonal, we'll have the variance at each time point, right? So the variance here will be the variance of this measurement, will be the sum of square of each of points with respect to the average. And the element 1 and 2 will be, you take the difference of each of these points with respect to the average, and you take all the cross products with respect to the difference of this point with respect to the average. That's how you estimate the covariance. Okay? And you take these and you average with respect to the treatment, and that's the formula here. And so that's how you get an estimate of these. You have these nice estimates of V that is fully dependent on your data, will have a dimension 5 times 5, and you have a lot of measurement at each time point that give you enough statistical power to estimate the variance at each time point and the covariance very well. Even if you had the short sequences, but each time point you have two or three trees, you know you can't do that because you cannot use only two data points to estimate the variance. Actually, you can, but the meaning of this V, the estimates of V as in a structural covariance measure will be an unreliable estimate, okay? So here we have a balanced data, short sequences, and a lot of data points at each time point. So then I get V, okay? And I save V, put on the side. Okay, now it's to my computer, I have V hat. Then now I tackle the problem of estimation or test of hypothesis. Is it effect of the treatment on the growth? And to be able to estimate the treatment effect, I have to specify a parametric model for the mean. Okay, so I'm not specifying this model because I can't, I mean, potentially I can, but it's much more efficient to estimate the parametric model for the mean and doing a test of hypothesis. So how we specify the, bless you. Actually, before I go there, so one thing that we did then, so I estimated V, and this is how the estimated the covariance matrix look like, remember? That's it, V0, we'll have dimension 5 times 5, and you see all the elements of V0 are very similar. So it's basically suggesting that that a uniform model could actually work. And similar thing for the V0 estimate for the other year, right, which is just larger because you have 8 or 9 measurements. Okay, so you have the estimates of V that you will use later. So now we need to test the hypothesis. Are these curves different? So what this show actually, what we have is four curves because are basically the mean at each time point for the four chambers. And then because the chambers don't make any difference, my blue and red are basically are the average of the two curves for the two chambers. And one will be for the treatment and one will be for the control. And we need to test the hypothesis, are these two curves different? And similar here, you have that these are the two curves for the treatment, these are the two curves for the control. And so basically what this plot is, it's basically taking these guys here, which are obtained by calculating their average at each time point and plotting one on top of each other, right? And then you can actually combine these two and these two, these two and these two, okay? And so now we need to test the hypothesis. Are these curves different? Different. And so to test an hypothesis, we need to specify a parametric model. And so if you look at this here, it looks like that the two curves are actually almost, I mean, the same, very close at the beginning. But then after the five time points, they tend to diverge. Okay, you see them to be get different. When this one, it looks like there is always a shift, okay, for the entire year. So by just visually looking at this plot, you see that the parametric model for the mean for the year 1988 must be different of the parametric model for the 1989 because they behave in a different way. So how we specify the model? Okay. So again, this is I'm specifying the model for the mean, right? So for the what I did with that. I lost the model for the mean. you have it, so I can write it down, but see if I can find it. Okay, well, I read it up. So, for the year 1988, what I do, I specify, if I can try to be consistent with the other one, okay. I'm going to specify the model for the mean, mu, I call it the mu 1, as a function of time, which will be beta j, and the mu 2, as a function of time, will be beta j plus, I think you have gamma and tau, right? Yes, plus tau plus gamma tj. And this is the control, this is the treatment, and j is 1, 2, until 5. Okay? So, by writing in this way, what's happening is that the treatment effect, which is going to be the average under the treatment minus the average for the placebo, will be equal to tau plus gamma tj. So now looking at this picture, and this is why biostatisticians can become very creative sometimes. So if you let's see if I can get this without, okay. So just look at this one, okay? So not ignore this one. So I'm just doing for 1988. So what I do, I'm modeling the difference between the two curves, okay? Because this is the parametric model for one, That one is a parametric model for two. And I modeled the difference as a linear function of time. Because you see, by looking at these, it looks like that these curves are getting different more and more as the time increase. Okay? Which basically, what I'm doing is, I say that the model under the parametric model for the mean under the control, I'm just allowing a different parameter, beta j, at each time point. So I'm not making any assumption on the shape of this guy. I'm not saying this curve is linear, because you see, I'm saying mu 1 tj, which basically is the expected value of yij as a function of j, is equal to beta j. So I'm saying as a different value at each time point. So because this one is not even, it's not really linear, it's not quadratic, so I just leave it as it is. Okay? But then I'm saying the same curve, the curve under the treatment, it's still the same bj, but will differ by a constant plus a parameter depend on time. So when you take this one minus this, the treatment effect, which is really what I want to test, the difference in the two means at each time point is a linear function of time. For this guy, I actually do the same, but without tj, because actually this guy is simple. Because you see the difference of the two curves at each time point, it looks that it's always the same. So it's just a function of tau. So in this case, to test the hypothesis there is no treatment effect, I have to test the hypothesis that both tau and gamma are equal to zero. Here, to say that there is no treatment effect, it means that ozone does not affect growth, I have to test the hypothesis that tau, only tau, is equal to zero. So that means I have to fit a regression model that gives me the point estimates of this guy and the appropriate standard error. Okay, so how I can do that? One, I can just fit ordinally square. We know it's wrong. We know it's wrong. We saw the covariance matrix, the alpha diagonal elements were very far to be zero, right? So we will get the wrong standard error. Number two, we can assume that the model has a uniform correlation structure, fit our regression model to this, and assume that our V is a uniform, and we will test the hypothesis, which will be close to be right. Or, what we did in this example, we have estimated V, right, from our structure, so we have our V saved somewhere, and what we're going to do, we're going to just fit ordinally square, but we're going to robustify the standard error of this guy by our V. If we're going to get robust under error. And so that's actually what we get. So we had the results. So what, and these are the, so for the year 1988, we get an estimate of the mean at each time point under the control. So these are the average under the control, which actually will be really, should be really close, or literally take the measurements under the control and average out at each time point. Okay? And the standard error. And you see that the average increase. Then we have the estimates of tau, which is not statistically significant. That means that when you take the difference, actually it does, the intercept is zero. But the slope is significant. So it is true that there is a treatment effect, and the treatment effect is acting by suppressing growth in a more dramatic way as the time goes along. Okay, so that's what happened in 1988. And how we have calculated this, how we calculate all of these guys, by doing ordinally squared, but with robust under error with our V. And you could try to do the same thing by doing a uniform correlation model And I will be surprised if you will come up with different conclusions. You're probably going to get very similar conclusions. Now, for 1989, we just have a simple model. We allow this simple tau, which is the difference of the two curves. And you see, this is also statistically significant. So it is true that ozone suppressed growth, but in 1989, the treatment effect did not vary with time. Okay? So actually, this is a pretty clever and advanced way of a specified parametric model for the mean, because here we are testing the hypothesis of whether you have a treatment effect that vary with time, which is, in longitudinal analysis, something that you might be interested to do many times, right? I mean, in many circumstances, you might find yourself in the same situation. And the answer is yes, the treatment effect vary with time. And it's more effective, you have a more, a larger effect on suppressing growth as the time increases. Okay? So, to see how the model fit, actually, so that was, this is what they estimated, this is actually the estimated curve, this one and this one. And these are actually the observed difference and the fitted difference. So actually, this is a nice way of really see if your model, is adequate or not. Okay. So let's try to wrap to see if we can make sense of all of this. So. With respect to specifying the unstructured covariance metrics, so the robust approach that we have described here, it's very simple to implement. I mean, actually, you don't do anything; you just do robust, right? In data. Now, the restricted maximum likelihood estimates of the covariance structure, which is really these, what I call the these are estimates of V, which where we take all the square differences by specifying a saturated model for the mean, are easy to compute, provided the fact that you have an experimental design that allow you to fit a saturated model for the mean response. Okay, if in the same analysis of the Sitka trees, we didn't have a treatment or no treatment, but we would have a continuous covariate that we will administer to each tree, we will not be able to do that because you cannot specify a saturated model. But if we have an experimental design as the one that we have just discussed, we will be able to do consistent inference of the regression coefficient for the mean independently of what is the true covariance metrics. So we don't need to worry about the fact that we might have misspecified the covariance structure at all, right? So it's a very safe approach where you can do it. So, on the other hand, there are also a lot of good reasons. So, I mean, as a reaction to this, if I can do the analysis without marrying any parametric model, then why do I ever need to specify a parametric model, right? So, if I don't need to have any pressure, well, so these are all the reasons why we need to have a parametric model for covariance matrices. So, one is efficiency. Although I will not say that this is the strongest, in my opinion, actually this is the strongest, but in any case, the theoretically optimal weighted least square estimate use a weight matrix whose inverse is proportional to the true covariance matrix. So it would seem reasonable to use the data to estimate this optimal weighted matrix as well. So basically doing maximum likelihood estimation for beta and V simultaneously. However, when there are n measurements per experimental unit, the robust approach, that's what I was saying before, use 1/2 n times n plus 1 parameter to describe the covariance matrix, all of which must be estimated from the data. So you might not have enough information to properly estimate all these parameters. Or you might still estimate this parameter, but this parameter would be so noisy that actually it's not clear if there is enough payoff of doing enough structural covariance matrix. And this is especially true when in a situation where, for example, the true covariance matrix might really involve very few parameters. So you might look at the autocorrelation function and really look close to be uniform or be close to be an exponential correlation model. Well, then you drop from 1 half n times n plus 1 parameter to 1 parameter, is our row. So you see that the gain in efficiency is actually really, really important. So all this to say that in contrast, the true covariance structure might involve many few parameters, which can themselves be estimated much more accurately than the unstructured covariance matrix, because then you're going to take all your data to just estimate your parameter row. So to wrap it up, in summary, the robust approach is usually satisfactory when data consists of short, complete sequences of measurements observed at a common set of time on many experimental units. And care is taken in the choice of the working correlation matrix, although care means that you're not going to use a completely crazy W, take a W, which actually could be just the identity, or some close to be like an exponential correlation structure. So in all other circumstances, actually, you might want to consider a parametric model for the covariance matrix.
Okay.
So is there any other questions? Yes, many, right? Well, I'm going to move ahead, but I don't want to have anyone really be totally confused or left behind. So the only thing I can suggest is, and I know this is a lot of material to digest, so please be, like, without any problem, email me if still the difference between robust estimation is not clear, and you feel up to this point that you have still some gap, and we will meet and we will go through that. Okay? There is, I mean, and I found this confusing every year myself. So there is no shame of being confused. Okay? So I'm going to move ahead. Otherwise, you have to think that also one of my mission is to keep all three of my TAs busy, so so I need to make sure at least I keep up with them. So what until now we have discussed a situation where we have equally spaced data, and everyone is measured the same number of time, and things are actually quite clean. Okay, in fact, we mostly spoke we described situation that has to do with trees, right? And we haven't ever discussed study that involves human subjects that are always going to be more complicated. And so what I'm not sure I'm going to do now is the last topic of analysis of longitudinal data for continuous data. I'm just going to show you several ways of specifying parametric models of your covariance matrix that you can do all the time, even when your data are not equally spaced. Okay? And so we're going to build on what we have learned on the uniform correlation model and on the exponential correlation model and kind of build on top of that. And so how it's going to work, if you have a regular space data and if you basically find yourself in a situation where you cannot do a robust estimation and you need to specify a parametric model for the mean, what you do is, number one, you calculate your residuals, and number two, you plot the barogram. Number three, you look at the barogram, and sometime the barogram will give you some guidance on how specifying the parametric model for your covariance matrix, which can be more complex than simply uniform or exponential. Okay? And so that's what we're going to do now. So basically, we're going to consider a general linear model for correlated data, but assume that the covariance structure of the sequence of measurements on each unit is to be specified by the values of unknown parameters. So the parametric modeling approach, we will see, is very useful when data in which the measurements on different units are not made at a common set of time. Okay? And so what we will do as a part of the lecture, we will do together the data analysis of the NEPL data set, where the data are not equally spaced and not everyone is measured the same number of times. And so we'll see how it's going to work for that particular data set. So I'm changing the notations slightly because remember we now deal with the yi, but then yi, which is the vector repeated measurements for subject I, will be ni element. So the number of times that each subject is measured can vary across subjects. And the ti are the time points under which these measurements are made. Okay? So now each subject carries basically two vectors. One is when the measurements are made, and two, the magnitude of the measurements. And the three measurements, and then you have a second child, which is measured the first 15 days, and then come back 3 weeks later, and then come back 5 weeks later. Okay? So each person will have his own vector of time and his own vector of measurements. And we can still write our y as long vector of n. So n would be the sum of all the number of measurements across everybody. So n is the sum for all the subjects of Ni. And so it's defined exactly as we defined it at the beginning by piling it up to this vector of repeated measurements, one on top of each other, and similar for the time. Okay? So actually, this is the same notation as we went through a few weeks ago. So if you have the first subject as we measure three times, you will have this vector will have length three. And then if the second subject has been measured five times, the second vector will have length five, and so on. So basically, we just put one on top of each other. And then we have to specify now this huge covariance matrix for our vector V. Okay? So, see, when we talk about parametric models for covariance matrices, and that is exactly what we have done already. What we have done, we have identified these two models. Okay? So where I'm going to define by alpha are the unknown parameters of my covariance matrix V. And in this example, alpha involves only two parameters, which was the variance and the correlation coefficient rho. So when we deal with continuous data, which are correlated, and we deal with the marginal models for the mean, we need to specify a model for the mean. This is our regression model, and a model for the covariance matrix. And what we have done up to now, we have said, well, V of alpha can have a uniform correlation structure, or can have an exponential correlation structure. And what we have shown is that if you say that V alpha has a uniform correlation model, basically we are specifying the error by allowing a random intercept plus the measurement error. Okay, that was the lecture where we connected a parametric model for the covariance matrix, which is a uniform, with a model with a random intercept. Similarly, if you specify an exponential correlation model for V, that is equivalent of saying that your error, that we call W, are serially correlated, so basically have an autoregressive structure on order one. So if you go back to your notes, that was what was discussed. And the reason why I am going this way, because now what we are going to do, we are going to add the components of these, so then we can, so we're going to specify the error structure of the model in a richer way, so then we can specify covariance matrices V alpha. They are more general than the uniform correlation model and the exponential correlation model. So what we have discussed is every time you take the epsilon ij and you allow for a random intercept plus a measurement error, in this case, you are saying that V alpha is a uniform. And if you say that the error in your regression model has an autoregressive structure of order one, specified this way, you are saying that V alpha has an exponential correlation model. But now, if I'm going to be more fancy here, change, I'm going to get the V alpha, which is not an exponential correlation model, which is not a uniform correlation model, it's something else. Then actually might encompass both. Okay? So what we're going to do, we're going to try to understand the different sources of error, because if we understand the different sources of errors and how they're coming from, we are in a better position of specifying the alpha. Okay? Another way to say is, remember, this is the variance, and I'm sorry, let me maybe clarify this even more. Saying this is basically say that Y has a multivariate normal distribution with mean X beta and variance V con alpha, which is equivalent to say Y equal to X beta plus epsilon, and basically the variance of Y is equal to the variance of epsilon, which is equal to V of alpha. Okay? So our another way to say that we can write this as also the variance of the epsilon, right? So what I'm saying is that it depends, so my parametric model for the covariance matrix basically is derived fully by how we specify the error structure. For every specification of the epsilon, it will correspond. So if you specify epsilon in this way, then we know that V con alpha is uniform. If you specify the error in this way, then we know that V con alpha is an exponential. Okay. I would like you to do actually to go back to the notes of last week and make sure that that is totally crystal clear. Okay? Because we did that. So why we talk about datagram? Because our colleague Peter Deagle find a way of use the datagram as a very useful diagnostic for figuring out how many sources of error we have to include in our model. And therefore, what is going to be the resulting covariance method. And so basically, he proposed the following model. So this is the most general situation that you can have. So, and we will go back to this. So don't be too annoyed about it. So first of all, he started for the definition of the regression model. Okay, so just forget about this. Okay, so the first equation, it's just the definition of a regression model. You have a yij, measurement, subject I, time j, design matrix times the vector regression coefficient plus an error, epsilon ij. Okay? And what we are doing, we are trying to model the correlation of the repeated measurement by decomposing our error structure, which is our epsilon ij, into three different components. Okay? So, and that would be the most general way we can actually account for the correlation. So, remember, we start saying how the correlation for of the repeated measurement can come from. I mean, how that can occur. Okay? So there are really these two, I would say, two main phenomena how this can occur. One is through a random effect. Okay? So what is a random effect? Well, this is a situation where you have the repeated measurements within a particular subject are correlated because there are some inherent characteristics of that subject that make these measurements similar to each other. I mean, the classical example is for a human being is the genetic makeup, the genetic predisposition, right? So if you measure the blood pressure, or even if you measure the body weight of a particular person over time, these measurements will be correlated because it will be on the same person, and the same person has a particular DNA, the particular way of processing calories, and if this person will tend to be heavy, will always be heavy. Okay? So that's a situation where you have a random intercept. You allow for a within-cluster correlation, so this is not really something that depends on time. You see, it's something that there are some inherent characteristics of that subject that lead to that correlation. And so the way to model that correlation is to add a random intercept by basically saying each person will deviate by the average of this amount. And we look at these, remember, for the example of the pigs. And you remember the classical picture of the pigs, where you have the repeated measurements for the pigs over time, and you see there was this tracking phenomenon, so if the pig was heavy at the beginning, was heavy at the end. Well, that's the classical situation where the correlation of the repeated measurement can be nicely modeled with a random effect, because there are all a series of characteristics about that pig that we haven't measured that will make the pig always the biggest one. Okay? So that is a one source, a one way of including. So if you can say, well, so that's why we want to include the Yukonai in some situation, right? Then there is a second component that lead to correlation, which is the serial correlation. So that say basically that the correlation comes from the fact that what happened to the measurement the before will affect what happened to the measurement now. And so sometimes there are situations that how the biological phenomena works allow this correlation of autoregressive of order one. So one example is, for example, the protein content of milk, where we have the different cows that were allocated to a different diet, right? And so there was some cows that had a lupine-only diet, and then we measured the protein content of milk at each week. And so basically what happened is that the protein content of milk at a particular week will depend on the protein content of milk of the week before, simply because it takes some time to metabolize that particular diet. So there is something in the process that led to that serial correlation. And you will think about that the protein content of milk at week 15 will be more similar than the protein content of milk at the previous week than, 10 weeks before, right? So still, we talk about correlation, but it's a kind that the correlation comes from a different source, okay? And so that is what we call serial process. And so what we did now, we always thought about these two things separately. Or we think about random effect, or we think about serial correlation. But we actually can allow for both. And then the last one actually has nothing to do with correlation. It's simply noise. You always have to have some noise on top, because especially if you have, when you measure the protein content of milk, well, if you measure this for the same cow at the same number of times, many times you're going to have measurement errors, right? So that's the usual noise that you have. So basically, what the general models say is that you can take the error structure, epsilon ij, and say that the total variability in your measurement that is not explained by the covariate can actually be explained by the different process. And by allowing all of three, we are basically allowing a much more general specification of the covariance matrix. Because, for example, on the diagonal of the covariance matrix, we will allow not only the total variance, but we'll also have the variance of the random effect. Remember, V squared, which is basically say how the people are different. Okay, so that would, this would be the variance of the random effect of the heterogeneity. So now the total variance will actually be the variance of the random effect plus the measurement error. So we have two. And you will also allow, because there is a serial correlation, we will also allow that the covariance between the two measurements at two different time points will be depend on the time difference. Okay. So you have a data set, and you calculate your residuals, and you calculate your variogram. And that is the most general way that the variogram can look like. And so let's look at all the different components. Okay? So remember, the variogram will be of three different things. One, if each of the variogram will not start at zero. You have this picture on the textbook, so don't, I don't know if it's in your notes. And all of these is on your textbook. I'm not inventing anything, so it's not pen. So this is the shape of the variogram. And so if the variogram does not start, so I'm sorry, let me say start again. So you have your data set, you calculate your residuals, and you calculate the variance of the residual. And that is the total variance. And the total variance will be, and you plot the total variance. Let's say in this case it's 3, okay? And then you estimate the variogram, okay? Now, if the variogram does not start at 0, it means that you have measurement error, okay? If the variogram increases, and remember we looked at that before, when the variogram increases with a lag, it means that the autocorrelation function decreases with a lag. So it means that you have a serial correlation. It means that you have to include a serial correlation component. If the variogram doesn't touch the total variance, there is still this gap, it means that you have heterogeneity between subjects, which is still not explained by your covariance. So it means that you have included a random intercept. So there are really three levels, three ways of specifying your big covariance matrix. Okay, one is the random effect, so basically the general level of the response profiles based between units. Second component is the serial correlation. At least part of any unit's observed measurement profile might be a response to a time-varying process operating within that subject. Okay, there is a process that allows, and it, well, no, they are not allowed, but they lead to serial correlation. And you have the measurement error. The measurement itself, your how the blood pressure is measured, how the protein content of milk is measured, might have error, okay, and that's it. So the sum of these three will be basically what will be in the main diagonal of your big covariance matrix. And off the diagonal, you will have this serial correlation. Basically, you will have the covariance between the measurements that will depend on the time differences, allowing that the time difference could be different for the different subjects. And I think that right now I'm just giving you the theory, and then I think the important thing is to do it. So actually that's similar to what I said before. the subject-specific intercept U-Conai, express the degree of similarity to which all the observations of the same subject are similar. Sorry, express the degree to which all observations of the same subject are similar. So U-Conai is the subject trait variable, and the W is the serial process, and Z is the measurement error. Let's look at the data set. So that it's always important to basically balance between theory and practice. So this was a data set that we looked I think the first lecture, right? That was the one we were talking about, where so this was the data set. Okay? So you have 25 cows, 27 cows, and 27 cows. They were assigned to three different diets. Okay? And our hypothesis is to test whether there is a difference in the protein content of milk between the diets. And so what we'll need to do, we'll need to specify parametric models for the mean, estimate regression parameters, and estimate, you know, find out if there is an effect or not. Now, one thing that you can see here is that you're not in this nice situation of having all the cows measure the same time point. So in this situation, you can see that although the experimental design will allow you to specify a saturated model, well, partially, I mean, it was allowed to specify a saturated model because the treatment is just like a categorical variable, right? But you cannot really specify different means for each time point because these data are not equal, I mean, it's not all equal space, but not everyone is measured the same time point, right? So you can do robust estimation. At least there is not, for me, a simple way to think about how you can do it. Unless you round the observation, you force them to be equally spaced, right? So the first thing to do in this situation is to estimate the variogram. Okay? So then, and we can also we cannot estimate the autocorrelation function because, again, you don't have a balanced data set. So we have to do a variogram. So in your notes, so first of all, what I did in a very simple way, I specify a model for the mean, which basically I say the expected value yij as a mean alpha j that varies with time, and then I have the two binary variables for the two diets. And so basically by specifying the parametric model for the mean, what I'm doing, which I wrote on the bottom, is that the expected value yij if when the cows get looping, it means that both these variables are zero, so the mean will be equal to an overall mean plus a parameter alpha j, where you allow a different mean at each time point. And but you see here, because the measurements are not equally spaced, you're going to have a different number of cows will contribute different number of measurements at each j. Okay, and then similar, the expected value yj under the mixed diet, it means that this guy is zero, so I keep a beta 1, so it's beta 0 plus alpha j plus beta 1. And epsilon yj given the barley is, I keep this guy is zero, so it's beta 0 plus alpha j plus beta 2, right? And so one way of testing our hypothesis, actually we will go back to this data set, would be basically say that beta 1 and beta 2 are zero. If beta 1 and beta 2 are zero, there is no treatment effect. Okay, but we have to estimate all these parameters in a reliable way, accounting for the correlation. So first, we calculate, we estimate the variogram. And so we are basically calculate the difference mean at each time point, which is the saturated model for the mean. And so you calculate your residuals, with respect to the diet. And then you calculate the overall variance of the residuals, which is 0.087. So, and you estimate the variance. So I'm just going to show you. Actually, so let me show you how the variogram looks like first. So this is an estimated variogram, and you guys have been estimating variogram, I think, many times. So actually, you might want to do it yourself and see if you can get the same answer. And so this is how the variogram looks like. Some of the, there were missing data at the end, and so some of these VIJ were actually excluded for, because remember that you have it dropped out, so sometimes you don't have the sequence until at the last point. So there was 17% of the measurement that were excluded because of the missing data. So the variogram look at this way. So does it start at zero, increase with a lag, and then it doesn't reach the total variance. So this is the variance of the residuals, which was 0.087. Okay? Now, I want to point out something that I noticed this morning and that you have wrong on your notes. And please correct, and I apologize. So if the variogram does not start at zero, it's an indication of measurement error. Okay, so just cross it. And if the variogram does not reach the total variance, it's evidence of a random intercept. So just, I don't know what I was thinking that morning. So, I'm just going to stop here by saying that, and you have in your notes, actually, some of the theta commands to calculate this variogram, okay? But by taking this data set and by calculating the variogram, by looking at the variogram, basically suggesting that we have to have both. We have to have both measurement error and theory of correlation. It means that, and it makes sense because you might have, there are characteristics of the cows that we are not measuring, some traits of the cows that create correlation of the protein content of their milk, because you know we basically measure the protein content of the milk always from the same cow. So there are so many characteristics of that particular cow that are going to make that particular protein content of milk always high or lower, right? Plus, there is a serial correlation because of the biological process of how that works, okay? And so it really depends how often they eat. It depends on how they process it from the diet to the protein content of milk. There are both components. And there is also measurement error in terms that when we report a measurement of the protein content of milk, that is not always exactly the true one because there is some error in the process of how we made that measurement. So that means that when we specify our error, so this will be all the models that you can have, and that's how we're going to start. In this particular situation, we will actually need to do this one, okay? We will need to specify a model with a random intercept plus serial correlation and plus measurement error, okay? And we will see in Stata how you can do that. So we'll have this list, and that's how I'm going to quit for today, would be all the different ways that you can specify your error structure as you have expected the variogram, that will lead to five different parametric models for your covariance method, okay? Which will encompass different sources of error that lead to correlation in your repeated measurement, even when the data are not equally spaced. Okay. So what we're gonna do on Monday, I just have actually two slides more of theory, and then we're going to take the NAPL data set, and we are going to apply all of these models to the same data set by doing all the theta commands and so on, and comparing the results, and try to digest all of these by doing data analysis. Okay? Thank you.